Hi, friends. How we doing? Welcome to week three. It is very good to see all your faces and to worship with you. Thanks for being here tonight. I have the privilege of introducing our preacher for tonight, a longtime friend of mine, longtime friend of the well, really kind of since the beginning. In the beginning, Glenn Black was around the well. And has seen us kind of through many generations now. And very recently has joined us here on campus as the Executive Director of Christian Ministry. And we're so excited for the vision that he's bringing to our department and our campus. So please join me in a warm welcome for Glenn Black.
And because I've been around for many, many years, I sit while I preach. Thus, this contraption. How many of you believe in love at first sight? All right, bring up the picture. The first picture. Aww. You are all liars. This is my son, Gabriel. And yeah, he's pretty incredible. The next picture. That's how he watches television now. He stretches out and puts snacks. I have no idea where he saw someone else do that. Maybe me. Love at first sight. I want to challenge us a little bit on this tonight about what it means to experience love at first sight. I'm going to say this real quick. It's kind of funny to me that on stage tonight were two children of people I went to college with playing in the band, which that's the precursor for my age, which now I'm going to reference a movie that I first owned on VHS. Okay? When Harry Met Sally, probably one of my favorite romantic comedies of all time, and we are going to watch a few minutes of that right now. The premise of the movie is Harry and Sally meet while they're driving from Chicago to New York after college to start their lives, and they hate each other. They get to New York, they say, have a good life, and they walk away. They run into each other years later, become friends, and they're friends for many years, and then they have a falling out, and then they fall in love and get married. So not love at first sight. It actually took them 14 years to fall in love. But there's these great little vignettes of these old couples telling their stories of when they fell in love, and I just want us to watch that. And because I'm executive director, I get to make us watch it. So it's in my other duties as assigned. So let's watch that little 4-minute clip.
I was sitting with my friend Arthur Kornblum in a restaurant. It was a Horn and Dart cafeteria. And this beautiful girl walked in, and I turned to Arthur, and I said, Arthur, you see that girl? I'm going to marry her. And 2 weeks later, we were married. And it's over 50 years later, and we are still married.
We fell in love in high school.
Yeah, we were high school sweethearts.
But then after our junior year, his parents moved away.
But I never forgot her.
You never forgot me.
No, her face was burned on my brain. And it was 34 years later that I was walking down Broadway, and I saw her come out of Toffin Eddie's.
And we both looked at each other, and it was just as though not a single day had gone by.
She was just as beautiful as she was at 16.
He was just the same. He looked exactly the same.
We were married 40 years ago. We were married 3 years. We got a divorce. Then I married Marjorie.
But first you lived with Barbara.
Right, Barbara. But I didn't marry Barbara. I married Marjorie.
Then you got a divorce.
Right. Then I married Katie.
Another divorce.
Then a couple of years later at Eddie Colicchio's funeral, I ran into her. I was with some girl I don't even remember.
Roberta.
Right, Roberta. But I couldn't take my eyes off you. I remember I snuck over to her and I said, what did I say?
You said, what are you doing after?
Right. So I ditch Roberta, we go for coffee, a month later we're married.
35 years the day after our first marriage.
We were both born in the same hospital.
1921.
7 days apart.
In the same hospital.
We both grew up one block away from each other. On the Lower East Side.
On Delancey Street.
My family moved to the Bronx when I was 10.
We lived on Fordham Road.
Hers moved when she was 11.
I lived on 183rd Street.
For 6 years, she worked on the 15th floor.
I worked for a very prominent neurologist.
As a nurse, where I had a practice on the 14th floor, the very same building.
We never met.
Never met.
Can you imagine that?
You know where we met? In an elevator.
I was visiting family.
In the Ambassador Hotel in Chicago, Illinois.
He was on the third floor. I was on the 12th.
I rode up 9 extra floors just to keep talking to her.
9 extra floors.
Well, he was a head counselor at the boys' camp, and I was a head counselor at the girls' camp. And they had a social one night, and he walked across the room. I thought he was coming to talk to my friend Maxine, because people were always crossing rooms to talk to Maxine. But he was coming to talk to me. And he said,
I'm Ben Small of the Coney Island Smalls.
At that moment, I knew. I knew the way you know about a good melon.
A man came to me and said, I found a nice girl for you. She lives in the next village, and she is ready for marriage. We were not supposed to meet until the wedding. But I wanted to make sure. So I sneaked into her village, hid behind a tree, watch her washing the clothes. I think if I don't like the way she looks, I don't marry her. But she looked really nice to me. So I said, okay, to the man. We get married. We married for 55 years.
And a 2-week courtship. And I think my favorite part was when the lady says, Roberta. Anyway, tonight we're going to be talking just a little bit about a story that feels like it has nothing to do with love at first sight, but we'll come back to that a little later. We're actually going to be in John 5. We've been spending a couple weeks looking at other passages in John of Jesus' encounters with people and the grace message that he brings to them. We're going to continue in that tonight. Excuse me. Now, as I read through this passage, we're actually going to read through it a bit at a time while I preach, so we're not going to read it all up front. I want to kind of save the ending for you a little bit. So just follow along on the screen as we go. And so we're going to go ahead and start that now. We've got the first slide up here for the passage. John 5, starting in verse 1. Sometime later. I'm going to stop right there, because I just want to say, don't you love the timeline that John lays out for us, all the detail? Sometime later. We already know from the previous passage, Jesus has been hanging out in Samaria and doing his thing there. And now we know, sometime later, he's moving into Jerusalem. So Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by 5 colonnades. Okay, the Sheep Gate was the first gate that was rebuilt in Jerusalem when Nehemiah took some of the exiled Jews back into Jerusalem to refortify the city. This was one of the first gates that they rebuilt. You can read about that later in Nehemiah chapter 3 if you want to. The reason it was called the Sheep's Gate is because on the outside of the gate was where the pasture was, where they would care for the sheep that were going to be slaughtered for for the sacrifice in the temple. And on the inside of the gate was a pool where the sheep were cared for before they were cleaned up and taken in for sacrifice. So Jesus typically entered in through this gate, and I'm actually wondering if maybe he was referencing this gate when he actually said about himself, I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will go in and out and find pasture. Now, I'm sure that not too many of the sheep that went in through the gate ever actually went back out for pasture, if you know what I mean. Most of them ended up in the field where your family pets went to live a long life. Is it too soon to bring that up? Ask your parents later. Perhaps Jesus was creating an alternative ending for us in what this place was about by this very moment in this very story. Let's read on into verse 3. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed, and they waited for the moving of the waters. From time to time, an angel of the Lord would come down and stir up the waters. The first one into the pool after each such disturbance would be cured of whatever disease they had. I want to note at this point that in most of the early manuscripts, verse 4 is not in there. There's no explanation of the angel coming down and stirring the waters. That was added later, and my guess is it was added later because people were consistently asking, why are these sick people laying by the pool? And so someone at some point thought, let's put in a bit of an explanation. And as a side note, does it sound like God at all to say, okay, the fast ones, I'm going to cure them? I just think that's an odd thing. The people who get in the water quick, that's the one I'll take care of. That's a complete sidebar. It has nothing to do with our conversation. So you can do with that whatever you'd like. On to verse 5. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes in ahead of me." Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." At once, the man was cured. He picked up his mat, and he walked. This is a very unusual miracle in the Gospels. The miracles don't usually happen this way. Typically, we find people approaching Jesus to be healed or crying out to be healed or some other kind of scenario, but we very seldom see Jesus face-to-face encountering someone and them not asking. Actually, I looked at 28 of the healing miracles of Jesus, and this is the breakdown. 12 of them, someone directly asked Jesus to heal them, and he did. In 6 of them, people cried out, according to Scripture, and 3 of those 6 were people who were demon-possessed. That probably had something to do with the crying out. 7 of them simply healed with no interaction whatsoever, like Peter's mother-in-law, where there was no interaction between Jesus, but Jesus went ahead and healed anyway. There's only 3 instances I could find where Jesus is face-to-face with someone, and they don't ask for a healing that he gives. Anyone have any guesses? Can someone name one? I'll give you a clue. One of them was dead. Yeah, there you go. Lazarus wasn't in a position to ask. Let's just put it that way, right? So Lazarus is healed without ever even asking for it. Then you've got the dude in the garden that Peter cuts his ear off, the soldier. And Jesus says, "I'm not going to have it," glues the ear back on. Well, it doesn't glue it back on. You know what I'm saying. Heals him with no aid from glue. The other one is this story, the story that we find in John 5. The man seeking the miracle doesn't actually ask Jesus to be healed. And what's more surprising to me is that when Jesus offers this guy, "Hey, do you want to be healed?" he doesn't say, "Sure, that would be great, mister." He makes an excuse, right? I mean, I think sometimes we've read this passage and we've thought, oh, the poor guy, he can't get into the water. 38 years? You know, it's interesting also that we read in here, when Jesus learned he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked. So even Jesus seems to come from his awareness that the man's been laying there for 38 years and hasn't found a way into this pool. Don't you think after 38 years, I don't know, you might have found a new trick? You might have seen what worked for someone else. You might have decided to get up early and get to the pool or get a seat by the edge or brought a taser along to get the other sick people away from the pool or whatever trick you needed to come up with, right? 38 years. 38 years, and he hadn't yet found a way. I actually wonder if the man was more comfortable embracing his broken state than in seeking healing. As horrible as it sounds in beggar cultures, the more wounded you are, the better your economic opportunity. My parents actually traveled to India a number of years ago and met a man who was horribly crippled in his legs, and upon hearing his story, found that his parents had actually broken his legs as an infant because they knew that he would have better prospects as a beggar than he would in his poverty. Perhaps he didn't want the healing because healing comes with responsibility. If he's no longer a beggar, maybe he has to work. Sometimes our own brokenness might keep us from seeking healing or seeking restoration because we're just more comfortable there. If he were delivered and made whole, would there be another expectation placed on him? The thing we have to remember at this point is Jesus loved him. Jesus loves us, even before we've ever met him. He's already loved us. And love refuses to let us stay in our state of brokenness. It refuses to. Jesus is almost dismissive in his response. I'd like to think of maybe like this is snarky Jesus with a roll of the eye or something, right? When he just says, get up and walk. It's not the kind of encounter that we usually see Jesus have with people. Anyway, the man simply gets up and walks. So, end of story. Miracle concluded. Is it just me, or does it seem like that's less than the miracle that we want in the story? Typically, Jesus' miracles are followed with some kind of celebration or thanksgiving or some kind of excitement or response from the recipient who receives this gift. So my question is it possible that there's a miracle behind the miracle in the story? And of course there is, otherwise I wouldn't have brought the question to you tonight, so you don't have to answer. The key to this actually gets found in the next section. So our next part of the passage here, the day on which this took place was the Sabbath. All together now. Dun, dun, dun. Like you can hear it in the story, right? This happened on the Sabbath. In the Gospels, these words always mean bad news for Jesus, right? Always mean bad news for Jesus. This happened on the Sabbath. It's the same kind of feeling that you get when your significant other says, we need to talk, right? And of course, you're sitting there saying, why do we need to talk? There's another episode of Seinfeld coming up. The Jewish leaders weren't upset that Jesus had healed this man. They were upset because of the day he chose to do it. The choice that Jesus made on that day, and actually that he makes every day, is he chose grace over law. And that gets you in trouble with folks who live in the law. Now, the laws that actually govern the Sabbath are called the Shabbat. Shabbat, I'm not sure if I'm even pronouncing it right, law. And that governs the actions on the Jewish Sabbath. And a lot of those laws are actually still in place for people who practice those laws. And I'm not trying to judge or anything, but they're crazy. They really are. It's amazing the level of dedication that is called to this choice of life. I'm going to give you some examples of those tonight. No writing, tearing, or erasing. And I just learned this week that tearing would include toilet paper. So before the Sabbath starts, you tear off the amount of toilet paper you think you will need for the next day and leave that waiting. No business transactions whatsoever, including shopping of any kind or exchange of any kind. No driving or riding in cars or other vehicles. No use of telephone. Yeah, these are all modern, just so you know. There weren't telephones then, if anyone was wondering about that. These are actually contemporary laws, but reflective of the ones we saw in Jesus' time. No turning on or off electrical appliances of any kind. So if you knew you would need the lights on the Sabbath, you better turn those on before the Sabbath starts. No gardening, no lawn mowing, anything you might even consider to be relaxing. All these laws that were in place, and apparently carrying your mat that you laid on for 38 years was one of those laws. Jesus typically gets called out for being Jesus, right? he gets in trouble for being who he is. Everything that his nature calls him to be. This whole idea of being a man driven by love to offer grace. Let's read on. And so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." But he replied, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" So they asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick up and walk?" The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. So Jesus' mistake was telling this man to break the Shabbat law, to pick up his mat. And again, I'm surprised at this dude's unexpected response. If someone had told me in this situation, "The law forbids you from carrying your mat," I'd be like, "Screw the law, here's the mat." Like, I'm walking for the first time after 38 years, so I don't even care what day of the week it is, right? But that's not what this guy says. He comes up with a second excuse. "It's not my fault. It was that tall, handsome, European-looking man with the great smile that told me I had to get up and walk. And so I did." Notice that he hadn't taken the time to learn Jesus' name. Now, in all fairness, the author tells us that Jesus slipped away like some kind of ninja, didn't stick around, but the guy didn't even ask the people around him, "Who was that that just did this for me?" Didn't even inquire of any of the disciples that were likely traveling with Jesus. So here we are. The miracle behind the miracle. What I'm going to propose is really the deeper meaning of the story that we're going to encounter today. And it can be found in three little words. And I'm going to see if you can spot that in this next passage. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who had made him well. Did you catch the three words? These three little unassuming words that changed everything for this man, and if they were spoken to you, would change your life. Jesus found him. Jesus found him. A man who wasn't looking for him. It's even hard to imagine that he was looking to be healed. As we said before, perhaps his brokenness had already become his identity, something he was comfortable with. And we need to ask ourselves tonight, how true is that of us? What place in our own life have we become comfortable with the wounds that we carry? And maybe they've come to identify us in ways that they never should have. Jesus found him. Even if we give him the benefit of the doubt that he simply lost hope in healing, did he simply come to decide that hoping for healing was more painful than actually moving into living into the brokenness? And so that's another question for us then. Have you found yourself unwilling to dream of forgiveness or love or freedom? Jesus found him. And Jesus finds you. He finds you. Maybe on another night, or maybe tonight. Jesus looks at you with love, whether you deserve it or not, and I'm guessing you don't, because I don't. But he looks at you with love, and he speaks to you as he did to the man in John 5, giving you some sense of hope for a different world and a different life and a different perspective. One that's lived in grace, not in law. one that's bounded to his affection for you and not his expectation of you. An encounter with unconditional, undeserved love changes everything. It changes everything. This promise was not received all that well in John 5. As best we can tell, if we read on to the next few verses, the encounter with this man actually set Jesus on a path for persecution and ultimately his death. It was at this point that the leaders decided this guy can't be preaching this message. So after this man left Jesus and he went back to the Jewish leaders and said, the guy you want is Jesus. He's the one who broke your law. If he hasn't already done so, Jesus has found you tonight. And that's why we gave you the little name cards tonight. We had it really all set, and it was awesome. We were going to have the, hello, my name is Jesus, and they got printed, and they're in the mailroom, locked up. So we didn't have those for you tonight. So imagine that the cards you have say, hello, my name is Jesus. It's his introduction to you. And what, as we're going to take some time tonight, what we're going to ask is love at first sight from Jesus too much to expect? Can we actually expect that the first time that he encounters us, it's an encounter of absolute affection and absolute love, without question, without any judgment of where you've been or what you've done? So as the band comes up, and they're going to play a bit for us as we end our time together, I want you to take out your cards, your name tags. And some of you, I know some of you may have put your own names on them, because right, that's what you do with these, right? That's all right. You can still take them out and grab a pen. And what we're going to ask you to do is I'm going to propose to you that through this card, Jesus is asking you, do you want to get well? Do you want to get well? And what I'm going to ask you to do is spend a few minutes praying for what it is that you want to say, first of all. Is your answer yes? Then I want you to write on that card the thing that you're asking for Jesus to bring healing into your life about. Or the thing that you want delivered from, or the promise that you want to see brought to fruition in your life. And just write that down as a reminder to yourself that tonight you encountered Jesus, and this is what you've decided to do in response to him. The truth is your answer could be no, that you don't want to be healed. And that's okay too, because it doesn't change anything for Jesus. He's still in love with you. And he still will leave here with you tonight. And he'll be present with you because, like I said earlier, love will not put up with brokenness. It refuses to leave brokenness alone. So he'll continue to meddle with you until the day you say, yeah. Okay? So take some time tonight to do this, reminding yourself that without exception, Jesus chooses grace over law, and our call is to go and do likewise. With your friends, with your family, with strangers, with your enemies, grace over law.